Good afternoon. Welcome to our session on pediatric vascular anomalies, what's new and improved. This is in fact gonna be a what's new and improved. This is not gonna be an introductory, what are vascular anomalies. And looking around the room, I see most of the people here are already pretty familiar with vascular anomalies and have been to similar type sessions or participate in the field. This will be co-moderated by myself and Michael Cunningham. And so we're representing pediatric general surgery and pediatric otorhinolaryngology from both perspectives. And our speakers that we invited are really a panel of world-class experts in this field. For those of you who work in this field, you know it is in the field. It's an interdisciplinary collaboration. And in order to understand these patients and take care of them well, it really does take a partnership amongst disciplines. So we have spectacular panel. To save time, I'm going to sort of mention who the people are now and let them proceed. And we're going to try and stay on time. And at the end, we have a couple of cases where we'll do a sort of panel question and answer. How would you manage these cases? The panel hasn't seen the cases. Michael and I have put a couple of cases together. So we'll be starting with Annie Kunkowski, who is my field of pediatric general surgery, and she is the surgical director of the Vascular Anomaly Center at Colorado Children's Hospital at University of Colorado. She'll be followed by Denise Adams, who is the premier hematologist oncologist in the world in this field, and really is the person who brought medical therapy to malformations, something that some of us thought would not be possible, but we are certainly grateful for. She'll be followed by Ahmad Al-Amari, guru of interventional radiology and pattern recognition in the field, and then be followed by Gresham Richter, who's really first-class pediatric otolaryngologist. I can say that. They don't use the rhino down there. We have the rhino in Boston, so in Arkansas you skip that one of the syllables, and really has helped lead the world in head and neck lesions, both from a surgical perspective and medical therapy, basic science, and laser therapy. So this is really a first-class panel, and we hope that it will be worth your time. This is my only slide, and this is just showing the variety of why we need a multidisciplinary approach to these patients, because no two patients are the same. Without further ado, we'll move into Annie.
All right, great, thank you. So I'm gonna delve into some of the surgical management of torso, extremity, and gastrointestinal vascular malformations. No disclosure. So some of the surgical considerations and principles when we're thinking about surgery is we're gonna preserve all neurovascular and all vital structures. Close wounds, large wounds over drains, and when in doubt, please perform a biopsy, as sometimes you can be misled that it is not indeed a vascular anomaly. Consideration of labs, when to draw blood, and when to communicate with the anesthesia team, and always, most importantly, is that the patient and family are engaged in the decision-making process. And once again, that this is a multidisciplinary team caring for these patients with these complex problems. So this is not an uncommon presentation. A baby presents with a large neck and axillary lesion where we get an MRI and the patient has what we call a macrocystic lymphatic malformation with some microcystic disease along the chest wall, and sort of are, you know, wondering, you know, the family's asking us what to do. This child, we recommended sclerotherapy of the neck lesion first, as the baby was having issues with neck mobility. The child underwent sclerotherapy, achieved cystic decompression, and delayed the debulking procedure of the chest wall until the child became more mobile, at which time, when he was learning to crawl, couldn't use the arm well and couldn't put the arm down, and so took the patient to the operating room to debulk the chest wall with preservation of the neurovascular structures out along the arm and also with preservation of the nipple areolar complex. Another child who presents with a trunk and abdominal wall lesion. The family was actually, very comfortable with watchful waiting of this. As the child moved towards kindergarten, the family was contemplating, what to do with this. So an MRI was obtained that shows lots of microcystic disease with a little bit of macrocystic disease. And I was then called on. I happened to be the person on call that day called by the pediatrician. Attrition with what was felt to be an incarcerated hernia. And I said, I'm not really thinking that this is probably an incarcerated hernia. Send the patient to the emergency department because I'm convinced that this is probably some of the retroperitoneal lymphatic malformation coming out the internal and external rings, mimicking an internal, inguinal hernia. So took the patient to the operating room, put in a laparoscope, really just to prove that there was no hernia, and then debulked the lymphatic malformation along the spermatic cord, both internally and externally. And the patient did very well with this. And so the family then decided that they wanted to move forward with debulking of the soft tissue component on the chest wall, which was, relatively very simple, straightforward, an ellipse of skin down to the abdominal wall and chest wall musculature. And the family, so another principle here, you can see the large bore drains here. The family was very pleased with the cosmetic result and had him ready to go to kindergarten, granted with a scar, but not any additional soft tissue. So this is not an infrequent phone call occasionally from the oncology team where a patient presents with abdominal distension and, there's quite a worry. An ultrasound was, performed that showed these cystic structures in the abdomen followed by an MRI. The stars mark the big macrocystic component filling the entire abdominal and pelvic cavities. We recommended sclerotherapy, and after three sclerotherapy treatments, got this down to a very manageable size. The patient then re-presented a year later with acute abdominal pain, and I was phoned at home. I said, just get an MRI rather than a CT scan to help figure out, where we stand with this. But I would not advocate getting MRIs routinely for this, as this is very simple to follow with ultrasonography. This is another way occasional intra-abdominal mesenteric lymphatic malformations can present. Occasionally, patients, these are found antenatally. So this was a baby diagnosed through the fetal care center with a mesenteric issue that we performed an ultrasound followed by MRI and fetal, in the first weeks of life, and took this patient after a failed sclerotherapy attempt to the operating room for a diagnostic laparoscopy. This is very simple. I'm sure many of you are more than capable of doing this, and pull the intestine out through a small incision at the umbilicus with a segmental small bowel resection. Patient goes home usually 2 to 3 days after return of bowel function. And the reason why we advocate for treatment of these intra-abdominal lesions is that we want to prevent volvulus, as this can serve as a lead point. And this patient, who it was not identified in, unfortunately has had to go through years of intestinal rehabilitation. Venous malformations present variably, hands, extremities, and so when large, we do recommend that we check for a localized intravascular coagulopathy that can result in an elevated D-dimer and variable elevation in the PT and PTT. If these patients are found to have what we call LIC, then we do occasionally recommend that the patient be treated with low molecular weight heparin for around the time of procedures. This is not an uncommon presentation of a patient with who comes to our center complaining of extreme pain in the knee. The family noticed that this six-year-old was walking on what they told me was a peg leg and had been to the rheumatologist really without a clear diagnosis. And an MRI shows here an effusion. You can see the patella with an effusion behind the patella. And I called up our orthopedic colleagues, and he took the patient to the operating operating room for an arthroscopy. You can see the venous malformation in the joint space that they're able to debulk for us. And at the bottom image is some hemosiderin staining that remains, which is very characteristic of ongoing bleeding into the joint that leads to early arthritis and occasionally complete joint replacement later in life. Sometimes, this is a very rare diagnosis, you can see these multifocal venous malformations on the palms and soles, which should tip you off for gastrointestinal involvement. This is a rare syndrome called blue rubber bleb nevus syndrome, BRBNS is much simpler to say. And these multifocal venous malformations can affect the small bowel, colon, and can result in bleeding requiring transfusions. And so Dr. Fishman invented a technique where you can make an enterotomy and intussuscept successive links of intestine to perform polypectomy, because obviously we want to preserve intestinal length in this situation. Dr. Adams will allude to the sirolimus and the advent of this medication, as many patients now don't need to go on to intestinal surgery because you can keep their anemia at bay. And then this is a rare, but when you see this pink staining in the perineum or the genitalia of a child, it should be a tip-off to get an MRI of the abdomen and pelvis, as there can be associated full thickness colorectal involvement with a venous malformation. Occasionally, you can have ectasias of the mesenteric venous system, and we, Dr. Fishman and I, noticed a pattern of patients presenting with this who already had developed portal hypertension, and we theorized that these big ectasias serve as a way to create clot that propagates into the portal system. You get cavernous transformation of your portal vein, and recommend essentially that you ligate these large venous ectasias to prevent that. And you can treat the full thickness colorectal involvement with an endorectal mucosectomy and a coloanal pull through to ameliorate the bleeding. And this can all be done, you know, through minimally invasive techniques. This is just the variable appearance of venous malformation on colonoscopic imaging. And lastly, there's sort of two overgrowth syndromes, Klippel-Trenaunay syndrome, where the patients present with hypertrophy, usually affecting a limb. This is the most classic appearance. And the reason we care as pediatric surgeons is that there can be associated marginal veins that can predispose these children to the development of DVTs and pulmonary emboli. Here's a marginal vein on an MR, and these veins connect anomalously back to the cava or through the iliacs, and DVT can become a pulmonary embolism. So we recommend, you know, talking to our IR colleagues to consider endovenous laser ablation. But occasionally we see these children when they're too old or in adult life where the vein is too big to be treated with endovenous laser techniques and would advocate for surgical resection. The arrows showing a DVT, that's what we're hoping to prevent. And then we can never downplay the psychosocial effects of being born differently, right? Where you can't fit into jeans that your peers are wearing or regular shoes. And so Klippel-Trenaunay typically is an extra fascial soft tissue growth where you can really get to the heart of being able to debulk these extremities for them back into normal clothing. And lastly, Clove syndrome. I won't get too much into the eponym as it's there for reading, but as a pediatric surgeon, the most important thing to identify is one sort of Clove syndrome, and then screening for Wilms tumor, as 3.3% of these patients will go on to have a Wilms tumor. And there are associated skeletal issues that I involve the orthopedics team with. And occasionally, these large lymphatic malformations can not follow the rules. This one blew up on us very quickly. The patient was floridly septic and admitted to our ICU. We recommended that we move forward quickly with a debulking to help clear the infection and the sepsis, so performed a another elliptical incision where we debulked the soft tissue and closed it over a wound vac because he was still sick and on pressors, recovered him about 36 hours later, brought him to the operating room again for delayed primary closure over the large drains, and the family was pleased in the end. You can see that he has the truncal lipomatous growth still, but that's not affecting his quality of life as a toddler. So thank you.